and welcome to episode 42, an auspicious number, of this little podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. My name is Perry Middlemas, and I'm here face-to-face today with my erudite co-host, David Grigg. Hello, David.
Hi, Perry. How are you? It's nice to be recording in the same location after a while. It's we get to see each other face-to-face now. We've no longer restrictions. But the real reason is that my next-door neighbour has decided to renovate his place, and there's all sorts of drilling and hammering and crashing going on next door at my place. So we figured it was better to move to a different location. So I joined Perry at his house.
It may well have offered you some nice little background noises, but some of them might have been a tad loud, but at least it would have sort of allowed people to know that we are actually doing this in the real world, as opposed to any other worlds we might inhabit from time to time.
Indeed, a bit of atmosphere.
Yes.
Yeah, indeed.
So this is an auspicious number 42, David.
Well, indeed. So of course that is the answer to life, the universe and everything, according to Douglas Adams and his great computer in his books called Deep Thought, which is a bit of a joke, but you've got to be old to think of it as a joke, because you've got to remember back to the days of Deep Throat, either with a connection to the Watergate experience or the earlier film, which was a pornographic film, which we won't go into any more detail. But yes, Deep Thought was a joke on that. But yes, 42, the answer to life, the universe and everything.
I have a feeling, David, that we are not going to be providing people with a lot of the answers to life, the universe and everything in this particular episode. However, we shall get there. Now, I also wanted to bring up something which I hadn't told you about, but I think that I have a new literary term for you you might be interested in. Mm-hmm. It is Sundoku.
Sundoku.
T-S-U-N-D-O-K-U, a Japanese word.
Yes.
Which refers to the acquiring of reading materials, but letting them pile up in one's home without reading them.
Oh, that's very familiar. Yeah.
Yes, I think that's very familiar to a lot of us. I think there's a sort of view that it's a deliberate attempt to build up reading materials. I'm not sure that applies to either the two of us. I've bought a lot of books in the past, all of which I have had great intentions of reading. I just haven't necessarily got to.
Oh, yes.
That's going to be applicable to today's episode.
Yes, I certainly don't buy books unless I expect to read them. So that's, to buy them without an intent to read them would seem fairly perverse.
It is.
Unless you're collecting sort of fancy-looking first editions or something and you're making it an investment, but...
Yeah, I'm sort of the same. I mean, some of them are reference books, which you buy knowing that you're going to pick at, you're going to look at here and there, but you are actually going to buy them. You are buying them for the purposes of referring to them at some point in the future, just to basically fill a slot up on the bookshelf. Mm. Yes, can I have 4 metres of brown, please? Yeah. just to fill in those bookshelves which are just sitting there hovering and looking quite bare. But anyway, I thought that's going to be applicable because I'll explain more a bit later on.
Right.
But do you want to introduce today's?
All right. Well, we're going to use we're going to fire up the Hugo time machine again, sort of polish up its valves and get everything going. And we're going to take it back to the year of 1965. Now, where was the 1965 World Convention held, Perry?
The 1965 World Science Fiction Convention was the 23rd of that form. It was held in London in the United Kingdom, and this was LonCon 2 between 27th and 30th of August 1965.
Mm-hmm.
The guest of honour was Brian Aldiss,
right.
And the attendance was approximately 350 people.
Wow.
So at the time, 1965, that was a reasonable number, down on the numbers that were arriving at the major US conventions, which are probably twice that.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to remember, how many at AussieCon? 700, 600?
700, first I was wondering, yeah.
So, and that was about the number of attendees at the conventions in the US around this time. So 64 or 66, you were getting around 600 to 700, and then it slowly climbed up.
Yeah.
By the time it got to 75, they were into the mid-1000s,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, yeah.
So Ozzycon was about half the size. A lot of people were referring to it, as I recall, as being like a larger regional convention.
Yeah.
And this one at 350 probably felt fairly much the same. Mm. So if you had a local LA convention, you probably would have got 350 to it and around about that stage. So, you know, a reasonable size, but not being great. Mm. Now, we're only going to be dealing with the fiction categories, although we will mention the others as we go. We're working through each of the shortlisted works on the ballot for the novels and the short fiction, and then we'll mention all the other winners that were awarded at that convention. So I'll start off and I'll go with the first one. And the first novel that we want to deal with here is The Whole Man by John Brunner, published by Ballantine. Now, the main character of this particular novel, Gerald Howson, is born crippled in his body to a broken family. He's got an absent father and a disinterested mother. And his life becomes even more broken when his mother dies reasonably young. So he wanders the streets. Now, I originally thought this was an American city, but I think it's probably a British one.
I think so.
I think it's probably a British city. Yeah. It's unnamed. It's just somewhere. And he just wanders the streets living off that. Until he not really knowing what to do, he sort of gets to about the level of puberty but never achieves puberty, which we find out later on. But basically, he's short in stature, fairly crippled, and he finds it very difficult to actually move around. And then he has an encounter with a deaf-mute girl, which brings to fore his latent telepathic ability. So this is Whole Man is a novel that you wouldn't really get seen written anymore. This is one of those ones of the subgenre of telepathy or psi powers that was very popular with John Campbell and all that crowd back in the 50s and 60s. So you had things like This and Slan and Dying Inside, I think was almost the last one, and that would have been around about the early 70s, 71, 72, something like that. But you don't really normally get these written very much anymore. And anyway, Howson's attempts to heal both his body and his mind continued through the book until he discovers somebody with a major new talent that he needs his very specific help. He, when he meets the deaf-mute girl, he basically, in a form of communication, blasts out this telepathic beam, which is heard somewhere in outer space.
Yes.
And he's identified as being one of Earth's most powerful telepaths. And so he's brought under the care of a United Nations group, and he ends up being based in a facility in Ulaanbaatar in Mongolia. And he's there to help people who have telepathic powers which they don't know how to control, or who are psychotic and have needs of a telepath who can basically go in and help them, placate them, or help them get through their illnesses. And he continues along this way until he comes across, by accident, because he decides to take a bit of a leave of absence from the facility that he's in, and he goes back to his old hometown, and he catches up with a few people. He goes to a party and he meets up with somebody who has a sort of latent power which is really quite peculiar, and he determines that the only person that can really help this other person get to their full facility is himself, and that becomes part of his healing process. So he learns to heal himself by helping to heal other people.
Hmm.
Now, you find out that he has his telepathic power is basically situated in a part of the brain that deals with the body image. So his image of himself, I wasn't entirely sure how that one worked, but anyway. I think it was a bit sort of hand-wavy there. But the idea is that because his telepathic ability is so well-developed, it's overridden his body image in his own mind, and therefore his body finds it impossible to be able to heal itself. But this new person that he finds with this new power is able to help him to fix that body image problem. And so the novel ends with him basically looking forward to the fact that he may well be able to get over his debilitating physical ailments and become a whole man.
Yeah.
Now, this is an interesting book. It was this is a classic example of a science fiction fix-up, in inverted commas, which is basically that each of the three sections of this particular novel were published separately as novellas in science fiction magazines, Science Fantasy and one other, I'm not sure, maybe Science Fiction Adventures, in 58 and 59, and then brought together as a novel in 1964, published then, and then obviously being eligible for the Hugo Award in 1965.
I didn't know that, but it did have that feel to it,
Yeah, because it's not quite... It is sort of... There's three... Each of the three parts feels completely whole in and of itself.
Yeah.
And there's a bit of bridging material, but not really a huge amount. And I think he probably... In the first instance, I haven't read the first three original publications, so I can only assume that what happened there was that there was a, in the second and third of these novellas, there would have been a bit of reference back to the original and a bit of reiteration of the background.
Yeah.
The, in this particular novel, in the fix-up, the whole idea is to try and get rid of that stuff so that it actually flows, so it makes it look like a novel. I thought this is an okay novel, fitting into a subgenre we don't see anymore. It isn't really to the standard of Brunner's later works like Stand on Zanzibar, Jagged Orbit, Cheap Look Up and that sort of stuff. But every now and again you catch glimpses of really well-written material in this. It's, look, of the four books here, it is one of the two that I would suggest that people read. I mean, your views on these four may vary, David. But I think this is I think this one's okay. I gave it 3.5. I know that doesn't seem high, but it's a slight novel to me. But that will tell you exactly what I think about the others when we get to those. when we get to those a bit later on.
It wasn't a great year, really, was it?
Well, no, it isn't a great year.
Indeed. No, I like this. I think I gave it a 4 on Goodreads, kind of rounding up from your 3.5.
Yeah, well, mine rounds up.
We've said before that I tend to round up a bit. But the one thing I did like about it was the fact that the idea that one of the big uses of telepathy or professional telepaths was to act as peacekeepers, that they kept going into different countries where there were conflicts going on and they'd kind of talk to both sides and enable each side to see the other's point of view. I thought that was an interesting spin on the whole idea. So that was my idea. I quite enjoyed it.
I think part of my problem here was that I read this one first of the four.
Oh, okay.
If I'd read this one fourth, if I'd read it last, I probably might have given it another couple of points higher. But look, it's worth having a look at as in terms of Brunner's development as a writer. I think this is probably where you can start seeing that he's starting to change and move ahead. Instead of being sort of just a jobbing writer, he started to think about what he was doing and comes across quite well.
Yeah, indeed. All right. Well, I'm going to go on to my first one, which is Davy by Edgar Pangborn. And Pangborn's written a couple of novels. This is the first one of his that I've read. I quite enjoyed it. So let's see. I'm going to give it a literary term, and I'm sure our friend Lucy Sussex probably is going to send us an email saying, no, you got that completely wrong. But I think that the appropriate literary term for this kind of novel is picaresque. That's picaresque. It's basically the story of a picaresque novel is basically the story of a low-born character who is at odds with society and who survives by using his wits and sort of travels on a journey and various entertaining incidents happen to him along the way. And that's really very much what happens in this novel. But the main character, I thought, was quite an interesting one, and you do get sucked in and want to find out what's going to happen to him. So it's written in the first person. It's written in the form of a journal, but he sort of varies. He talks about the past, but he also talks quite a bit about his present circumstances, and then goes back to talk about the past and how he got to where he is now. So yeah, the protagonist is Davy himself. The first line of the book is, "I'm Davy, who was king for a time, king of the fools, and that calls for wisdom." Well, that was quite a nice first line. It doesn't actually end up really being a king, although this hints that they were involved in a position of power. later on, but we never actually get a real description of that in the book. But anyway, setting that aside. So the novel tells Davy's life story and how he came to be where he is now, which is living on some island in the Atlantic, which they think might be one of the Azores. And he's with a group of people who used to be in power in some small country, but for whatever reason, they've been overthrown and have escaped. Once they've been overthrown, escaped to this island by sea, on a sailing ship. So then the journal goes back to Davy's origins. And he was born a red-headed son of a prostitute in a town called Skoa, in a country called Moa. And we eventually understand that this is in part of what remains of the United States some hundreds of years after what Davy calls the years of confusion. And so there's been some kind of nuclear war, and civilization's been shattered and has returned to a kind of medieval level. It's a very common sort of theme in science fiction, isn't it? And North America has been broken up into dozens of small nations, and many of which are periodically at war with each other. There's a lot of terms and names of these various countries, which obviously spins off of real American places, but I'm not familiar enough with American geography to spot them all, but you get a bit of a hint of some of them. So because there's been a nuclear war, there are quite a lot of mutants being born. And we've got an organization called the Holy Merkin Church, and it does everything it can to identify mutants at birth and put them to death. But then a few of them get missed and survive to adulthood. Now, these mutants, unlike in the comic books, don't have any special powers. They're just mostly just disabled or deformed in various ways. So the basic story is that Davy, who begins life as a bond servant, because he's from very low origins, he's a bond servant and he wants to escape from his life. He's working in a tavern. And as the story opens, he's in his early teen years. He's very dissatisfied with things in his life. And he likes to sneak out from the town every so often into the forest which surrounds it. Although there's a curfew at night, you're not supposed to go out of the walls at night. And anyway, on one such expedition, he comes across a mutant who survived living in the wild, who's got a treasure. And the treasure is an ancient French horn, a musical instrument, the French horn. And Davy steals the horn from the mutant, and eventually he learns how to play it. But returning from the wild one night, he accidentally kills a guard on the walls of the town, and so he's forced to flee. And when he does that, there's a bit of a battle going on, and he avoids the battle. And he comes across a group of three people who are also traveling, and they take him in. And these include a man called Sam Loomis. And this is like a very, very common character in science fiction of the time, particularly the works of Robert Heinlein. You've got this old geezer who sort of takes a young person under his wing and teaches him about life with a really rough and ready philosophy. It could be straight out of Heinlein. And of course, as the book goes on, by an unbelievable coincidence, we finally discover that Sam is quite likely to be Davy's father. And Davy begins to treat him as such. So, various adventures happen on the road. Davy is this kind of clever trickster. He, comes into a town and steals clothes and other things that the group needs. But eventually they join a group of traveling musicians and actors. And because Davy can play music on the French horn, that becomes useful. And he's sort of taken into this traveling group. He spends quite a few years with this group. So it's all fairly entertaining and pretty easy to read, but there's not a lot of substance in the book, really, apart from this story of this particular character. The science fiction elements are really just the background of this shattered America and the fact that there are mutants around, but nothing much is done with any of that. It's just this background of this environment that this character's in. So it was kind of okay. Pleasant enough to read. Good character development of Davy as it grows up, but nothing deep and meaningful, I thought, in the themes. One thing I did like was Pangborn coining a term, quackpot, quackpot, which is a combination of quack and crackpot. If it's not yet in the dictionary, it should be, I think. So, yeah. What do you think of this?
I just think I'd seen it before so often. And this is the problem when you go back and read books from close to 50 years ago, you start thinking, I have seen this before. The background is a bit like the background of Canticle for Leibowitz.
Yeah.
There's a bit of that there. And there's also it also reminded me of some of Richard Cowper's the stories that I'd read, Piper at the Gates of Dawn, that sort of stuff, yeah. Where there's basically it's a post-apocalyptic world where climate change has come about. In this particular book, as in Piper at the Gates of Dawn, the sea levels have risen. And so we are talking here about a book that was published in 1964, and it's another one of those ones that you can look at it and go, oh, okay, so there was already a piece of an indication that people were aware that the sea levels were probably going to rise if things kept on going.
Yeah.
And you find that parts of the US which were probably just a bay, he refers to the Hudson Sea as opposed to the Hudson Bay. Now, I didn't really figure out whether that was because it was just so big in terms of his experience that he thought it was a sea because he couldn't see the other side, or whether it was actually a sea completely, that it had been opened up a lot more to the Atlantic Ocean. Don't know. Mm. We're not terribly sure. But there's a lot of little hints about bits and pieces there. I really couldn't get engaged with this book terribly much. I sort of thought it was going on and on. I thought, well, something really should happen, and not a lot does. And I sort of struggled with this one a fair bit. I mean, I hadn't remembered. I'd read an earlier book of Pangborn's called A Mirror for Observers, which was he wrote back in the 52, 53, somewhere around there. And I read that a long time ago, and I've got a fond memory of that particular book, though I haven't read it in 30-odd years. But I don't think this one's up to that particular standard. Not one of my favourites for this year.
Fair enough.
I only gave this one a 3.3 out of 5.
Yeah.
But then we move to the next one, The Planet Buyer by Cordwainer Smith. Now, I should tell people that this is basically half of a later book that was published after Smith had died called Nostralia. Nostralia. Got to get that right. Nostralia.
Well, I'm sure that Cordwainer Smith would have pronounced it that way.
But that's what our friends at the press basically like to, how they like to pronounce it. So Planet Buyer by Cordwainer Smith fits directly into that Nostralia style. Now, Nostralia is a planet somewhere in the solar system which has been inhabited by old North Australians. And they have transplanted Australian Merino sheep to this particular planet. But something has gone funny with the sheep there in that they have become mutated and sick to the extent that some of them weigh hundreds, if not thousands of tons and need to be shifted and moved all over the place but can't basically move around on their own, but produce what is called... In their sickness, they produce what's called the Santa Clara drug, also known as Stroon. Now, this is particularly interesting because it prolongs human life indefinitely. And as soon as you start getting to this and you start thinking, well, there's one particular planet where one particular drug produces longevity or one particular thing, I'm thinking, hang on, this is a bit like Dune for Frank Herbert. So there's... You're almost, and that was Dune World was a book that we read the last time we did this.
Yeah.
So you're starting to see that there are a number of particular topics and memes and that were being used by various authors that were similar, not exactly the same, but similar, and just they were just exploring everything. Now, whether you want to say that Planet Buyer is a in conversation with Dune or not, I don't know, but I don't think they are.
No, I don't think so.
So anyway, the main character has got a name and a half. His main name character, and I had to write this down because I'm never going to remember this. His name is Roderick Frederick Ronald Arnold William MacArthur McBain, the 151st. Now, he's a sheep farmer on this planet of Old North Australia. And because of the fact that this drug is being produced, all of the farmers are incredibly rich. At various times, people have bought young sheep from these farmers and taken them off planet to try to get in on the market, so to speak, but all these sheep die before they are able to produce the drug. So something on this particular planet, and only on this particular planet, is causing them to be sick and therefore getting this drug. Now, because they are so very, very rich, the government has decided that to tax everything massively with huge tariffs of 20,000,000% and this sort of stuff, so that basically they just keep a standard middle class existence, even though by the rest of the galaxy's terms they are incredibly, incredibly rich. Now, most of the inhabitants of old North Australia are also telepathic, and in order to become an adult and therefore to become a human and therefore to be able to inherit your holdings for your particular family from your family and to be able to control all of your the sheep and all the wealth, you have to have passed a sort of series of tests that will prove that you are telepathic. Now, Rod, because I'm not going to give him his whole name all the time, Rod McBann, his major problem is that, yes, he is, but only intermittently, but when he is, he's got massive power. I thought, oh, okay. So we got two of these in the same same year, two telepaths sort of intermittent and massive power.
Yeah.
He finally is able to convince the people that after, well, generally what happens is they go in for a test, and if they fail, they sort of get moved back and their puberty levels are pushed back, and so they have to relive their life again from about the age of 2 or 3 up until 18 when they go for another test.
Mm.
Now, once you've done this 2 or 3 times, if you get to the 4th time and you don't make it, basically that's it, and they actually execute you because you're not going to be a, inverted commas, fit member of the society. He finally wangles his way to being getting through the test and he's going to be okay. But he's also on his farm. He has the planet's only all-mechanical computer, which he's kept up to date and kept going, and he likes playing with it. And on or around the day that he passes his test, he goes to this particular computer, and I'm forgetting exactly what he asks it to do, but what he ends up happening is the computer says that he will make him as a rich, the richest man in the universe,
yeah,
which he does.
Yes.
He sells futures for Strewn, for the stuff that McBain has got, and he buys and sells overnight and is able to manipulate the stock markets to such an extent that McBain gets to the point where he has so much money, he's actually able to purchase old Earth.
Yes.
And so he can, he does, he purchases the whole thing. When this gets out, this is a bit of a shock to everybody that somebody's actually bought it all. The question you have to ask yourself is, how is it that somebody has the title to the Atlantic Ocean that you can sell to people? You know, it's a bit like that classic idea of, you believe that, I've got this bridge I'd like to sell you, Australians are supposed to be able to do. But anyway, McBain decides that he wants to go and have a look at old Earth, and he travels back there in a strange manner back to on a spaceship back to the planet. And while he's going back there, the people that are protecting him basically say, well, look, whenever it gets out that you're the man that's bought old Earth with all this money, people are going to try and kidnap you and try and extort all this money out of you. So what we're going to do is set up a whole lot of sort of lookalikes. So they're going to be sort of 20 or 30 of these McBains all there looking exactly like you that everybody will go for, and you'll be the only one that they don't, because you won't look like yourself, and they'll change you into looking like an animal that's been upgraded into sort of human-like form.
An underperson. Mm.
An underperson. And he gets back to the planet, and that's sort of really about where it ends. Now, so you can really tell that this is like half the story.
Yeah.
There is another part that would have to come along afterwards. And so from that perspective, this novel feels unfinished, but nobody wrote like Cordell Smith. No. They didn't write like him then. They certainly don't write like him now. No. And even though the story is rather slight and basic, it shines.
Oh, yeah.
There's just such brilliant stuff in this in such a short period of time. It's only 150-odd pages, but it's got far more in it than just about all the other books in this whole list put together.
Yeah.
And it really, it's wonderful stuff. I really like this.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, it's rekindled my thought that I've got to go back and read a lot more Cordwainer Smith because there's a whole lot of stuff that he did in his instrumentality, which seems to be the overriding controlling authority of the galaxy, the instrumentality of mankind. They get mentioned in this, but they don't actually make an appearance. And all you hear about is, oh, this is the way the instrumentality would do it, or this is what they would allow to do. But there's no interference by them in what he's doing. I like this. It's because it's slight and because it's not all full there, I gave it 4.0 out of 5, but it's a good book.
But there's also a lot of subtle humour in it. I mean, when you think about it, the whole thing of the planet called Old North Australia, it's just such a funny riff on the idea of New South Wales. and really that whole business of the tariffs and so on was really, it's like a satire on the way Australia was in the 1950s and 60s.
Yep.
And it's very cleverly done from that point of view.
Well, we should point out that Cordwainer Smith was actually an American, was a pseudonym. And the gentleman who wrote these stories was actually living in Australia at the time and working for the US government. I don't know whether he was in a clandestine position, but I believe he was working for the US government either in their embassy somewhere while he was living here in Australia. Mm. And so he was obviously taken by that whole mythos of the outback and the hardy farmer and the tough old Australians that basically...
he saw right through it, I think.
Yeah, I think he did. I think he saw that it was just all a bit of a joke that that those of us that live here are fully aware that, that was a whole lot of put-on bluff and bluster by a whole lot of people. But it portrayed the Australian farmer as being big and tough and strong, and and being able to do whatever they needed to do, and he just took that and riffed on it. And it's excellent stuff.
Yeah, it is good stuff. You talked about Rod McBann's full name, and I've got a bit of a story to tell about that, which occurred to me as you were talking, and that's that in 1979. I and my lady, who's now my wife, went to the Worldcon in Brighton in 1979, and we were one of the things that we had organised to do at the masquerade was to help promote the bid for Australia in 1983, and as part of this thing, we had this little scenario we did for the masquerade. And several of us were involved, and we all dressed up as various characters out of Australia. And I was an underperson, and I had to go out the front, and I was wearing a mask, which was a goat head mask, as it were. And I had to go out the front, and I had to announce and introduce Rod McBann, the blah 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 blah, blah, all the whole thing, and I had to memorize it. So I can't do it now, but I had it all memorized, and so that was quite fun, and that all ended up with us unfolding a banner saying Australia in 83, which of course was a bid which didn't actually eventually succeed, but nevertheless it was fun. So that's my connection with that name.
Well, you would notice the name MacArthur in the middle there, so that's a lead back to the Merino sheep as well. Absolutely. Now that one's certainly worthwhile reading, and I will attempt to track down the second part of it and read the whole of Australia now, because I think that was, and also some of the other stories. I think that's excellent.
Yeah. All right, so what are we up to? Are we up to The Wanderer?
Up to The Wanderer, the winner. By Fritz Lieber.
The winner, oh dear. The fact that it won. Okay, where should we start? So The Wanderer by Fritz Lieber. So this is a pure science fiction novel from Fritz Lieber, who's probably better known for his fantasy works. The basic plot of the book is pretty easy to summarise. It's a bit weird, but it's easy to summarise. A rogue planet pops up out of hyperspace, It emerges at a point not far away from our moon. In fact, so close to our moon that tidal forces from this new planet quickly begin to tear the moon apart into a cloud of rocks, which the new planet appears to be consuming in some way. All these rocks are sort of disappearing down the gullet of this new planet. So the new planet appears to be about the same size and mass as the Earth, and the same tidal forces also begin to wreak havoc down here on Earth. It's soon discovered that the rogue planet is occupied by intelligent aliens who use flying saucers to travel through space using an inertialess drive, and they've broken up our moon to use it as fuel. Though I couldn't work out why they couldn't use any of the other rocks in the solar system, why they had to come and pick on our moon, but never mind. It wasn't properly explained. Anyway, eventually the galactic cops turn up in yet another mobile planet, and a battle starts between these two planets and culminates in both of them vanishing back into hyperspace, leaving the Earth behind as a mess. Millions of people have died, and we no longer have a moon or anything but feeble solar tides. End of story. Okay.
That's about it, really.
That's the story. In itself, this isn't a bad plot. I mean, it's a bit of a stretch, but it's not a bad story. But it's the way that Lieber delivers it which is the problem. Because it's written like one of those airport novels which have an ensemble of different groups of people to whom we're introduced, and we keep going back and visiting them as the events of the story unfold. And Lieber really doesn't do this well at all. Because there are so many groups of characters, the book just goes on and on. It's a very long book, as it describes what happens to each of these groups of people. And the problem is that there's so many characters. I think I added up, there's got to be at least 40 named characters. But we never come close enough to any of them or to get enough of a backstory on any of them to actually feel any interest or empathy in any of them. And so it's very, very tedious. So I went through yesterday and I actually tried to identify how many different little groups of people or little intros to different groups of people that he does in the book. And I counted 15 such groups. And at that I may have missed one or two. So you just keep on, as you read on, you just keep getting introduced to yet another group of people, another group of people, another group of people. And I kept losing track of who was who and where they were and what they were doing. So I just found it really very, very tedious. So I won't go into the business about why. I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff about flying saucers. Like they meet, a couple of the people meet up with a group of flying saucer enthusiasts who see all this happening in the heavens, and you know they're convinced that the aliens are here, which they in fact are. Somebody gets sucked up into a flying saucer and taken off into space, and discovers that the alien on board the ship is like a cat, a humanoid sort of cat. So this guy gets sucked up into the flying saucer, and he has a domestic cat with him for whatever reason. Of course, it was part of the group of saucerites people, saucer students who were on the beach when this flying saucer arrives. And so he gets sucked up, and the alien itself is a cat-like creature. And initially, the alien thinks that the domestic cat is the intelligent being that he sucked up, and not the human, who he thinks of as a monkey, who she thinks of as a monkey. Anyway, yeah, I say 15 different groups of people. And this, the other thing about the book, too, is, of course, it's set in its time, and so you've got to give it a bit of leeway, I suppose. But there are some pretty regrettable stereotypes there in the book. For example, the stereotypical alcoholic Welsh poet, you know, who's all he ever does is wants to get drunk and fall over and quotes poetry. There's a rich guy who owns a mansion, and he has black servants who he treats as stupid children, I suppose, as people like that did back then. But it really is offensive to read now. There's also quite a bit of sex happening in the book, though it's not explicitly described, but there's quite a lot of sex happening in very unlikely circumstances, I would have thought, in most of the cases. We even have a sex scene with the cat-like alien on board the flying saucer, so that, yeah, okay. Anyway, so millions and millions of people die because of the tides that this thing has raised up. But all that really happens behind the scenes. And the very many characters we're given to follow, there's nothing there that makes you want to feel anything for them or to care about them. So I scored this at 3 stars on Goodreads. I think it's amazing that it won the Hugo. But then the competition, as we've seen, wasn't all that great.
Not a very good year for the novels that were on the shortlist. I gave this one 3.4. It's too loose and too padded out. This just goes on and on.
Forever.
And it's bland. It really is rather bland. As you say, you don't really actually get to the point where you care a jot about any one of them at all.
No.
And you just think, oh, well, you know, maybe it'd be better if the Wanderer planet did actually explode Earth to put us out of our misery here. Maybe this world did well because it was probably the first book in the SF genre that actually was written like this, with this well, they're not points of view really, they're just multiple streams because they're all told in third person, not in first person, and so you're getting your your omnipotent narrator dealing with each of the streams of people, and some of them are rather racist.
Yes.
And some of them are just, you know, there's a whole bunch of hopheads that go floating through this that don't seem to go anywhere, don't do anything. It's just like, oh, well, I want to write about some guys that were stoners and I want to put those in.
Yeah.
They're going to do anything?
Yeah.
No. They're going to help? No. Right. They're just going to back to a little bit of colour in the background. Yeah. And you're going to think, no, not really.
There's even one thread where there's a guy who is climbing a mesa in Arizona, gets to the top, has a heart attack and lies down and dies. Not sure what that had to do with anything.
No, that's just a lot of padding, I think.
A little thread in there. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, well, it must have been I didn't like Lever's the Big Time, and I didn't like this at all. I don't mind his fantasy.
Fantasy is good.
Our Lady of Darkness that he wrote later on was absolutely fantastic.
I like Conjure Wife. Have you read that?
No, I haven't read that one. It seems as though his fantasy stuff was a lot better when he went into the science fiction field. I just don't think it worked.
I agree. Yeah.
Anyway, so it's. I think we've come to the conclusion that it really wasn't a terribly good year. Yeah, this so was it. But what about some other possible nominees, David? Yeah, what other things that were there? Greybeard by Brian Aldiss.
Right.
The Burning World by J.G. Ballard.
Ooh.
The Bloody Sun by Marion Zimmer Bradley.
Don't know that one.
The Towers of Tauron by Samuel R. Delaney.
Mm-hmm.
Three Philip K. Dick novels.
Wow.
Clans of the Alphane Moon, Martian Time Slip, and Simulacra.
Right.
I would have thought there'd be a couple in there that would have been better than this.
Mm.
The Great Time Machine Hoax by Keith Laumer. Hard to Be a God by Arkady and Boris Strugatsky. That probably wouldn't have got on because it would not have been translated. It was written in the original Russian and therefore probably wouldn't have had an opportunity to get on.
Yeah.
And two books by Vance, The Killing Machine and The Star King.
And both of those are part of his Demon Princes series. Yeah, The Star King was first.
Yeah.
So, they were both great science fiction novels. So, yeah.
So you start to wonder what happened here.
Yeah,
so now I don't have the statistics for the nominations, but I do have the stats for the voting, which you might find be of interest.
Yeah.
So we'll start at the bottom and work our way up, shall we? No award got. Now this is first past the post.
Yeah.
As you know, now we have this sort of
preferential voting.
Preferential voting that we utilise now, so that takes a long time to work its way through. This was just straight first past the post. If you got the most votes, you won. No award got 14 votes because no award is always a nominee, always a possibility. In fourth place, The Whole Man by John Brunner, 26 votes. In third place, The Planet Buyer by Cordwainer Smith with 34 votes. So my two favourites were third and fourth.
Mine too.
Davy by Edgar Pangborn, 48 votes. And The Wanderer by Fritz Lieber, 52 votes. So only won by four.
Mm.
So that's not really a huge margin. But I actually, in many ways, I would have preferred Davy to win the Wanderer.
Well, yeah, I would agree.
As much as I sort of couldn't really get engaged with Davy, I just found the Wanderer to be.
At least Davy has got an interesting character who he does engage you. You have an interest in the character, even though you know it's just this picaresque novel where he has things happen to him.
The life of Davy,
he's an interesting character.
Yeah, and he just goes from one particular point up until this point where he's writing it, and then he just talks about what he does.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, in the process, he gives you a view of the world in which he lives.
Yeah.
And that is of interest. Yeah. The Wanderer, just to me, isn't of interest at all.
No, it just goes
just,
on.
Just goes on. Not, just not there.
No, so do you think we'll do better with the short fiction?
I'm not entirely sure. I'm not entirely sure, David. So, okay, only three nominees in the short fiction category this year. I did a bit of reading about this, and there's a thought that, well, as it currently works, in order for a work to appear on any of the fiction categories, or I think probably any of the categories in the Hugo Award, they have to achieve at least 5% of the overall votes that were taken, so that you don't end up with 100 stories that have each got three, and you have to pick five of them. You know, so you have to basically get to the point where you've got to make sure there's enough people around that actually think this is worthwhile being on the ballot to get things started. Now, it might well be that there was a whole lot of stories that there was a spread all the way right across. I don't really think they were utilising that form at that time. Mm-hmm. I don't know why they only went for three, but they did. So they only went for three. So the one I'm going to talk about, first off, is Little Dog Gone by Robert F. Young, published in Worlds of Tomorrow, February 1964. Oh my God!
I was going to say, okay.
Look, I'll just read what I wrote about this because actor Nick Hayes, who's the main character in this particular story, is a world famous actor and an alcoholic, as they are. One day, sick of the grind of his life, he heads off to the stars and goes on a drinking stint, and he wakes up lying in the grass out in the middle of nowhere on some planet. Doesn't know where he is, doesn't know how he got there, doesn't know what the time is. And he wakes up and he sees a little dog. And he's lying there looking at this dog in a, hungover to hell, feeling like death warmed up. And as he's looking at this dog, the dog disappears and then appears somewhere else. And he watches this thinking, yes, I really am hungover, getting to the point where I'm being able to see this. But anyway, so he basically decides, well, I've just got to find my way back to civilization. So he drags himself back to the nearest town, and the dog follows him through there. And he meets up with this woman called Maura Blair, who sets out to sober him up. And he slowly but surely gets himself back together again, and the dog's still hanging around. And Hayes and Blair and the dog set themselves up as a travelling acting troupe, because this is the only way that Hayes knows how to earn any money. But he also decides that if he's going to be an acting troupe, they're not going to charge for the acting, because that's what he loves doing, but he's going to sell patent medicines on the side to earn some money. Okay. They train the dog to be able to teleport on when it hears a particular word, and to appear between the two of them when they're just about to go into a big clinch. Everybody thinks this is marvellous, and they are very funny, and they find out that the animal's called a doggone, or doggone, which I thought was a bit too cute for words. And so they travel to various planets taking this particular thing there, and they get more and more and more popular to the extent that Hayes has made an offer that he can't really refuse, or forced them to accept it, where he has to go and put this particular piece of acting on a televisual presentation. Now, the thing about the dog that he finds out along the journey is that the dog won't teleport into empty space, because it will only be able to teleport at the speed of light, theoretically, though Hayes never really does any testing of this. He just assumes that speed of light's the ultimate speed limit of the universe and has to work with teleportation as well as anything else. Okay, fair enough. That makes sense. But the dog's not going to try and teleport through a vacuum, because if he spends more than 3 or 4 minutes in a vacuum, he'll die of lack of asphyxia and also the cold. And he also finds out that the dogs reproduce asexually, so that the offspring, the new pup, is an exact duplicate of the mother. Anyway, so he and Maura split up. Maura keeps the dog. Maura's watching Hayes on television when he says the word, and the dog teleports and ends up with Hayes frozen solid and dead. And Hayes, of course, is distraught about this whole thing, gets in contact with Moira. And Moira says, oh, no, it's okay. There's the dog had a pup before it left, and here it is. And that's it. That's it. Now, I just read this as being like a standard Western story where a guy was basically trying to earn money by sort of travelling around as a sort of an itinerant acting troupe selling patent medicines. He's just Robert Young's just chucked this into a science fictional setting, and there's nothing much to this, and it's just instantly forgettable. Yeah. Like, there's nothing here at all, really. Yeah. No idea why this would make any list of the best stories in any particular year. I gave it 2.8 out of 5, and I think I'm being overly generous.
I think you are. I actually couldn't get through this. I read about. I suppose about the first 10 pages or something, and then just started skipping, and sort of then read the end of it, and it was, I just thought it was terrible. And so,
it's woeful. It's a woeful story. It's a nothing story. It really reads like it was just written to pad something out. Yeah. The guy had to meet a contractual arrangement to do it, and this is the thing he thought. So this is one of those ones where we read these stories so our listeners don't have to, David.
That's right. Yeah, I wouldn't recommend.
Recommend this one.
No. All right. So the next one the one I'll do is called Always a Cop by Rick Raphael. Now, this is a sequel to a story called Code 3, which was on the Hugo ballot for short fiction in the previous year, 1964. And I talked about it then and was fairly critical of it for various reasons, which I'm about to repeat, I think. So, like that story, this one is focused on the crew of a patrol vehicle of the Thruway Authority, which controls huge highways crossing North America, apparently including Canada and Mexico, as well as the United States. Now, these highways feature 4 half-mile-wide lanes in each direction. There's no indication whether these half-mile-wide lanes have got any further divisions in them. Don't know. Maybe not. Anyway, each of these major lanes are dedicated to vehicles travelling at different speeds, ranging from the slowest, green lane, at 100 miles an hour, which is 160 kilometres an hour, to the highest speed, the yellow lane, which allows vehicles to travel up to 500 miles an hour or 800 kilometres an hour. So bloody fast. So this patrol car gets involved in clearing up disastrous accidents on the throughways because inexplicably there's no automation of the vehicles on these highways. They just put people in them and they barrel along at 800 kilometres an hour, driven by humans who, of course, make mistakes like humans do. So, you know, like merging too quickly or failing to slow down in fog or rain or taking a curve too fast. Inexplicably, even the fastest yellow lane isn't apparently banked at curves. And so in one incident, a young couple slipped right off the edge of a mountainside because they've taken this curve too quickly, and they're killed. So the other thing I thought was puzzling is that although the patrol vehicle has got the equivalent of crash couches and airbags, there's no indication that ordinary passenger vehicles have any kind of protection like seatbelts even. So in crashes, passengers and drivers are routinely thrown out of their cars. So they're travelling along at these ridiculous speeds and crashing into each other. And every time there's an actual accident, of course, it's a complete disaster. Anyway, so the job of these patrol cars, which is the focus of the story, the patrol cars are kind of like a combined highway police, ambulance and fire engine. And the three-person crew, which is like a pilot or driver and co-driver, and a medical officer. And naturally enough, because of the sexist attitudes of the 1960s when the story was written, the pilot and co-pilot are men, and the medical officer or nurse is female. Now, in the previous story, there was this kind of a lukewarm romance starting up between Ben, who's the senior officer of the pilot, and Kelly, the medical officer. But it was pretty lukewarm. And anyway, here it continues in this story at a still lukewarm pace. I think towards the end of the story, Ben is finally brought to admit that he's actually in love with Kelly, at which point she goes all gooey and glows at him. Deep and meaningful it ain't. So we get to see a number of incidents that the patrol vehicle attends to, including some absolutely spectacular crashes, of course, because of the people are travelling these ridiculous speeds. And we get gory details of the results, all these burnt bodies and smashed up bodies and things. Well, okay, is there a plot? The plot of the story, if it can be said to have one, centres on a car that they pull over, it's been driven by a drunk driver in the fastest yellow lane, the fastest lane. And the patrol vehicle manages to force this car to an emergency halt only seconds before it piles into a group of vehicles who were involved in clearing up after a previous catastrophic accident. So the driver of the errant car is indeed drunk, but he is apparently the heir of an extremely rich capitalist, and he's outraged that he's being arrested by this group of people. And he certainly is going to get off because of who he is and who his father is. And so really the rest of the story is just how the crew of the patrol vehicle ensure that he doesn't, in fact, escape justice. So I didn't think much of the previous story, Code 3, and I don't think much of this one either. So, no. But did you read this one? What do you think?
Oh, I did read this one. I, again, don't think very much of this. Didn't think much of the other one. So no. I'm not entirely sure, again, why this, you know. It just seems to be... This one was an analogue. It's almost as if you had to have something from analogue in on the ballot,
yeah.
And they chose something. And surely there must have been something better in analogue that year than this.
You would have thought so.
So this is a very, very forgettable shortlist, to be perfectly frank. The winner, have you got anything more you want to say about it? Because I don't think there's anything else you can even really want to. I thought the story by Raphael was just completely forgettable.
Yeah.
Anyway, the winner was Soldier Ask Not by Gordon R. Dixon from Galaxy, October 1964. Now, this is a novella. It's a military SF, part of Dixon's chilled cycle of stories, so Dorsai being the best known of these. So 400 years prior to the start of this story, man's moved out of the stars, colonising a number of planets, and then splintering into specific specialised types, warriors on Dorsai, philosophers on the exotic worlds, etc. Now, the Friendlies are a race of religious fanatics. So they are another type of specialisation. Though you sort of get the impression that the Friendlies may exist across different planets. It sort of wasn't entirely clear, especially from this particular story. And if I've read any of the other stories in this cycle or series by Dixon, I don't remember them. Tam Olin is a journalist who has arrived on the planet of Saint Marie to cover a local revolutionary war. He's a journalist with the Interplanetary News Service. Now, each side on this particular war has recruited mercenaries. One side's got the Dorsai, who are strict, sort of almost Prussian-like soldiers, and the others, the Friendlies, where they basically are killing people because they don't believe in the same religious tenets that they do. Now, Olin hates the Friendlies as they executed his brother-in-law on New Earth, another planet, for no apparent reason other than expediency at some point, because they had captured him and that's the brother-in-law and Olin together. They were able to leave Olin because he was a journalist and they knew that he wasn't going to get involved in things, but they couldn't leave the soldier behind, so they shot him. Now, on Saint-Marie, it's obvious that the Friendlies are outnumbered and outgunned by the Dorsai-led troops and that things are going to end badly. The leader of the Friendlies realises there's only one way to bring the conflict to a satisfactory end, which he accomplishes by a very interesting little trick. Now, you see, the problem that the Friendlies have is that they can't surrender, they've been told. They have to stay and fight to the bitter end. But the Friendlies' leader is able to manipulate things to the point where he's able to save the majority of his troops by an act of self-sacrifice. Now, Olin is actually the catalyst for this solution because the leader of the Friendlies realises that he can utilise him to be able to get to the Dorsai to bring them to a negotiating table where this act of self-sacrifice appears or happens. But Olin's too fanatical in his own way to realise it and really doesn't understand what's happened or how it's or what's occurred until it's pointed out to him in great detail at the end. And even then, he still doesn't seem to understand what's gone on and what's happened. He doesn't also realise that the leader of the Friendlies has done the best thing that he absolutely possibly could have done to save the vast majority of his men by sacrificing himself and five very old worn out warriors on his side. And so the friendlies have achieved a result which is the best outcome that could possibly be attained. And yet Olin doesn't understand what's happened. And he leaves the planet still not knowing what happened. And so you think, well, this must be part of something else and something bigger. And I believe that it is part of another novel where the first... I think he expanded this into a novel called Soldier Ask Not. Okay. The idea is that Soldier Ask Not is, don't ask. Soldier, ask not what we're asking you to do. Just get on and do it.
Ask not to reason why.
Or ask but to do and die, yeah. or die. So, yeah, it was... where was this published again? This is published in Galaxy. You sort of wonder whether it had been offered to Campbell and he didn't want it. I don't know. It sort of would have fitted in with Campbell's views, I would have thought. Not much here with this particular book. With this particular story, I gave it 3.4, rounded down to 4. It's probably it's the best of the three, but that's not really saying very much. It's overall, this is not really a very good year in terms of what it is that the stories that are there. Your overview of this particular year for these short fiction?
They're all pretty crummy stories, really. That's all you can say, isn't it? None of them really leap out at all, and it's sad. And certainly that one about the dog, I mean, that's just...
It's pathetic, really.
It's pathetic, yeah. To see that on the list, goodness me.
Well, given that we've been looking at some stuff over the last couple of Hugo Time Machines, where you're starting to see things... progressing, you know, you're seeing the arrival of people like Zelazny and a number of different stories which have got, you know, a bit of oomph to them and a fair bit of interest to them. And then you get these three and you think, they're all just meh. There's nothing here. Yeah. And you can just completely easily just skip these and not really worry about them terribly much. Mm. Now, other possible nominees for this particular year and some of these names that you will recognise. Brian Aldiss again for Man on the Bridge. Three by Ballard, The Drowned Giant, The Illuminated Man, and The Terminal Beach. Mm. I guess The Terminal Beach wasn't made into a novel. It was a collection of stories, so that would have been the major one in that story. First one that I can recognise from an Australian, Damien Broderick's The Sea's Furthest End. Mm. Philip K. Dick, The Little Black Box. Mary by Damon Knight. Now, a lot of these I don't know. Mm. But then there were three short stories by Ursula K. Le Guin, early stuff. Yeah. Two of them, The Rule of Names and The World of Unbinding, are very early stories in her Earthsea series. And either of those, I've read those two recently, and either of those two are far and away better than anything else that was there.
I can imagine so.
And the other one was Semele's Necklace by Le Guin. Michael Moorcock's The Big Fix. Frederick Pohl's Father of the Stars. Three by Cordwainer Smith. The Boy Who Bought Old Earth, which sounds like the precursor for The Planet Buyer, really, because that's, you know, McBain-ism at The Boy That Bought Old Earth.
Yeah.
The Crime and the Glory of Commander Zuzdal, that's a great title. The Dead Lady of Clowntown, another good title, by Cordwainer Smith. Yeah. And the last one by Roger Zelazny, The Graveyard Heart. Mm. Now, I haven't read a lot of those, but even the ones I have read are better than the ones that were there.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Not good.
Yeah.
So, moving on to the other awards that were given out in this particular year, we have the Drama Award went to Dr. Strangelove.
Yes.
That's a good one.
Great
name. Best Publisher went to Ballantyne. They had three novels on the Best Novel ballot, so you can probably understand that. Best Magazine was Analogue, edited by John W. Campbell Jr.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Best Artist, John Schoenher. I think he's probably best known for his Dune illustrations in Analogue, but he also did the illustrations for the Raphael stories.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So to be perfectly frank, the illustrations are the best thing about that. And the best fanzine of that year was Yandro, edited by Robert and Juanita Coulson, which is a famous fanzine. Now, I'm not sure whether you want me to go through the awards. Interesting, for the best short fiction, No award won, had 30 votes, Little Dog Gone 27. Mm. So, and Soldier Ass Not 60, went 60 votes, and Once a Cop by Rick Raphael, 47 votes. So, you know, there wasn't, so there was a fair win there. Mm. But, yeah, so that was, I think this is probably one of the poorest years that we've covered in the Hugo Award time machine. Mm. So 1964, I think there was probably a lot of good work there, just didn't appear on the ballot. Mm. And given that the Hugo Award was the only award being presented in the science fiction field in that particular year, you're not getting a good view of what else was going to be there.
No, that's right.
Mm. We're still 2 years away from the Nebula Award making an appearance in 1966.
Uh-oh.
And so we look forward to hopefully the 1966 or 60, well, maybe it's next year's. Anyway, we look forward to 1966 Hugo Awards with some interest. I hope that it's a bit better than this particular group.
Yeah, indeed. All right.
And so that brings us about to the end of that discussion. And that's about it, David.
Sure. We should talk about what we're doing over the Christmas break.
We should. We're actually going to have a break.
Indeed.
We were intending originally to have another episode of the podcast coming up in 2 weeks, but that would push us right up next to Christmas, and the person that I was going to be interviewing about a certain group of books and I came to the agreement that we'd basically put it off for a few months because things were going to be a bit rushed, and we've sort of felt that we've done, what have we done, 25 or so episodes this year? Mm. So we haven't missed a fortnight. So we're going to be pushing things back a bit into middle of January, probably about 11th or 12th of January.
Yeah,
we'll
12th,
have our next one. And the first episode will be our best ofs.
Best of 2020.
2020 for
what
best
year,
of,
yes.
Yeah, what a year. Best of the 2020s for our books. And then the follow-up after that will be best of the year for our film and television.
Mm.
I think it'll be a lot of television without very much film, David. I don't know about you, but I can't remember getting to the cinema this year.
No, I certainly didn't. And so I'm going to have to catch up with some of the TV before we get to that point. So I haven't watched a lot of TV this year too. So we'll see.
Yep, so that's basically what we're going to be doing there. And then we'll be back in the new year with a number of ideas, which we will cover as we come to them. We won't put them too far ahead because I think we decided in the middle of this year that we've been pushing things a little bit too hard in terms of the number of books we were asking each other to read.
Yeah, it's nice to be able to relax and just read what we feel like reading, not what we feel we have to read.
So. Yeah, so yeah. To a schedule. And so we're going to be a little bit more free and easy next year, a lot more of what we've been reading lately, or just sort of a crime episode, which could be about anything rather than any one particular
sure.
topic. So we'll be having a few more of those episodes next year. But that's it for 2020. I hope everybody has a good Christmas and New Year, that you get all the book presents that you want. I've been informed that there's a couple that are coming my way, which would be good. Not sure exactly what they're going to be, but I could probably hazard a guess, but I'd better not, just in case I get into trouble.
Yeah. As long as you don't go and buy them yourself. I almost did.
I'm in the bookshop, but I need to buy this. Don't buy that book for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, all right. Well, I'll just buy. Yeah, all right. I'll just move on to something else then. So you've got to be a little bit careful at this time of year about what it is you pick up. Anyway, David, that's it.
That's it.
So it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me too.
And we shall see everybody in 2021.
Indeed.
Have a good end of year.
Indeed.
Bye.
Bye.